As the president of the Women's Action Organization, and I shall promptly now turn this meeting over to the vice president for the Department of State, Idris Rosell, who's from the External Research Section of INR. Idris?
Once again, may I invite you to move down toward the front, especially Mr. Conley, I see sitting in the back row. We are pleased to see the interest in this program, as shown by the attendance here today. There are a number of visitors from other agencies, and we welcome you, as well as our own employees and their families. Just within the past couple of weeks, the 14-year-old daughter of one of our Foreign Service officers, we have seen the tragic consequences of sexual violence against a 14-year-old daughter of one of our Foreign Service officers. Just a few weeks before that, a new State Department secretary, 20 years of age, was raped on a nearby thoroughfare. The statistics on rape are up. While the FBI's crime index shows a nationwide decline of 1% in overall crime, violent and property crimes, violent crime itself is up by 4%, and forcible rape, one of the seven violent crimes, is up over last year by 8%, and that in just the first 6 months of 1973. Last year, some 46,000 women were raped in this country and reported it to police. It's estimated that 10 times that many women may have been assaulted, but because of ignorance or shame, did not report it. Young girls and women, and yes, their families too, must learn how to deal with this problem on the medical level, on the counseling level, and on the legal level. They must also be taught how to prevent rape and how to defend themselves in the event of attempted rape. That's why we're here today. The board of Women's Action Organization recognized the problem some time ago. We decided to do something about holding seminars on rape. I won't go into the details of how this program came into being, but I must mention a few facts. First, Elaine Fry, vice president of WAO for USIA, approached the Federal Women's Program Coordinator in USIA and received a sympathetic hearing, but the answer was no. Our State Department Federal Women's Coordinator thought the Civil Service Commission might be the central point for such a seminar in the federal government, but the answer was no. Then WAO decided to approach our own medical office. Skeptical at first, they were willing to listen, and then were convinced that such a seminar would serve the needs of not only employees, but also families, just as the alcoholism and drug abuse programs do. So the medical department and Women's Action Organization are co-sponsoring and sharing the costs of putting on two sessions of this seminar by the DC Rape Crisis Center. Those of us in WAO, and we hope all of you, will agree that such a program should become a part of the regular medical program. We have handed out questionnaires, which we hope you will turn in as you leave. A word of thanks is due to the medical office, especially to Dr. Nidell, the head of the medical department, who cannot be here today because he's on a trip. I understand that Dr. Watson is in the audience, and also all of the other, and I see him, and several of the other doctors from the medical department, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in a row up there, are also here. We want to thank them, we want to thank Visual Services, and all who have helped and are helping out today to bring you this first in the federal government, a seminar on rape. There will be a question and answer period at the end of the program. Dr. Lanahan, representing the medical office here today and seated in the front row, and a charter member of Women's Action Organization, will be happy to assist the members of our panel in answering your questions. Copies of Rape Prevention Tactics will be available to you as you leave the auditorium. Now to our program. Two women are principally responsible for all of the work. First is Francine Bowman, please stand, of the medical office, and a board member of WAO. Ms. Bowman held the first discussions with the medical staff and then handled all the administrative details from there on. Second is Carol Curry Gidley, whose timely memorandum to Gladys Rogers on the rape of an associate and colleague served as a catalyst to bring her and WAO together. Ms. Gidley has handled the direct contacts with the D.C. Rape Crisis Center and has worked on publicity and other aspects of the program. Ms. Gidley will introduce Karen Colias, co-founder of the D.C. Rape Crisis Center.
We're really glad y'all are here. We'll all learn along together. I want you to meet three fine human beings, the women who run, without salary, the D.C. Rape Crisis Center. The center is the first in the nation, the same one you've been reading about in the Washington Post, in Ms. Magazine, and most recently in the Progressive Magazine. Karen Colias, the co-founder, is earning her bachelor's degree in political sociology at American University, in addition to running the center. She's traveled extensively throughout America, helping other cities establish their own centers. Most recently was asked to come to Canada for this same purpose. Karen will deal with community education about rape. Sue Leonard is a Bondo Karate expert and teacher. She will discuss and demonstrate self-defense today. Darlene Cole is earning her master's degree in international studies at AU. She's also employed with Common Cause in addition to her work at the center. She's worked extensively with the United States Attorney's Office in Washington, D.C., the D.C. Police Department Sex Squad, the Prince George's County Task Force on Rape, as well as the Public Safety Committee Task Force on Rape for the D.C. City Council. Darlene will discuss the legal and mental health aspects of rape with us. Women, welcome to State.
As Carol said, my name is Karen Kleiss, and I wanted to give an overview of what the Rape Crisis Center is and the concept of a service project with political motivations, working toward change, and starting on a local level and increasing and going out towards national ends as well. We opened the project itself as a 24-hour crisis hotline in June of 1972. Our main priority was to service the immediate needs of rape victims. So we were trained paraprofessionally for crisis counseling, crisis intervention. We provided housing, finances, and all of the emergency needs that a woman might have if she was raped or attacked, especially if she lived by herself and she was broken into. Those kinds of things we were dealing with. However, before we started, we did a lot of research. We went around, we talked with the police, we talked with the sex squad, which is the group of detectives that work with rape and assault cases. We went to the emergency rooms, found out the procedures that they had, and also found that, according to the doctors that saw women who were raped that came into the emergency rooms, the procedures were according to the individuals who saw the women. So we called in, we found out all the different things, and would give the information out to women, help them make decisions, or go along with the decisions that they made, whether or not they wanted to report rape. Now, as was mentioned by Ms. Rizal, only 5 to 15% of rapes are ever reported. So we were working with a lot of women who were not reporting rapes because we felt that they should get adequate medical treatment and their needs met just as much as women who were reporting rapes. We also found out and went through the experiences with women who have been reporting them to the police and found out which police were cooperative, which weren't necessarily cooperative, and the same with the medical profession and psychiatric referrals. We soon found, like right after, we got a lot of coverage in June of 72. By August, we were getting a lot of national requests from interested women, from individuals who thought that what we were doing was really good and important, and how could they get something going wherever they were located, whether it was, Minnesota, California, Texas, Louisiana, everywhere. And so we thought, well, we better put our information together, how we pulled together, and get it out fast. So we put out How to Start a Rape Crisis Center, which is an organizational manual. And it's since gone through two printings, and we're down to the last issues again. We've been fairly distributed, and now we've helped set up rape crisis centers in almost every large city across the nation, and now, as was mentioned, things are going to be going in Saskatchewan, Canada. And, we're really excited about these things. A lot of women have been doing, are still working on the emergency hotline concepts, maybe working with other hotlines or switchboards that were existing in their city. Some of them were set up within government institutions, like in Philadelphia, there's a group called Women Organized Against Rape. Their office is in Philadelphia General Hospital, and they work with the staff in the emergency room there and the police. And so they're kind of like on the inside, making sure that the people that are supposed to be doing their jobs are doing them right. We chose to work outside of the institutions, but still apply those kinds of pressure points and work in coalitions and groups that would have people from the institution, such as the DC Task Force, which Darlene will go into. But those were people, let's say representatives from the police and the hospital, and then us as well. So we could work with them, make our suggestions, make our position clear without, you know, necessarily being a part of those institutions. So, and we found that both in Philadelphia and with the group that we're with, both ways are effective, and that there are even more ways to work around the issue of rape besides these two. So we decided with the How to Start a Rape Crisis Center and its demand that we were going to have to be responsible to a larger constituency than D.C., and so we set up kind of like a national clearinghouse system, and we've been doing a lot of national correspondence. We've had a lot of national speaking requests, and we go around and speak and help people set up centers, and we keep in contact. And to the point where every once in a while we will get calls from women who have been raped across the country, and we'll be able to refer them to other places, you know, that are closer to where they're located. So those are the two things that we have basically been concentrating on. The third aspect is the one that I wanted to spend a lot of time on, which is community education. What have we been doing in D.C. besides meeting the immediate needs of rape victims? We feel that service projects in and of themselves can stay service projects forever, such as the case with abortion counselors. You can counsel women where to have a good abortion, what kind of abortions, how do they feel about it, and follow them through and never change. You can see a million women once each time, and that's it. The service in itself is no threat to anybody. It doesn't really state anything other than we want to help women who need help in this one area. We wanted to get above and beyond that, and so what we wanted to do was go out and say what we felt about rape. We have a political analysis about it. We feel that rape is a crime that affects all women, and that it is a crime that limits women in terms of our daily lives. Whether or not all of us in this room will ever be forcibly raped, we'll all several times in our lives have that fear immediately before us, and the fear usually on a long-term scale underneath us. You know, whether or not that services, and we can see this by the kinds of response that we always get, and how many women always call and say, I can really relate to what you're doing. So we feel that that's a very important thing. And the fact, too, that it took women, and mostly rape victims, to set up something like this. When there was a lot of publicity last year in February about the George Washington University women's case, then everybody got all upset. You know, there was no conviction given. And people were saying, what, is there no justice? Was there no justice? And people were calling us and were saying, well, this goes on a whole lot, and, you know, we're used to this. And, you know, like, call the city council and things like that. Well, the city government pretty much felt foolish and responsible for what was going on. So only after those immediate threats and questions to them did they decide to start something. They set up the D.C. Task Force on Rape, which we were part of. So you see, there's a difference between being able to see what kinds of needs women will understand and pick up on and work around, as opposed to waiting for a whole lot of things to come down, you know, tragedies coming down until the contradictions are so clear that people are finally forced to move to action. And we see this as something that's clearly different. So we do go around, and one of our important things is prevention. Obviously, the whole idea of a rape crisis center, it would not be as effective if all we wanted to do was wait until a woman was raped and then help her out. We would like to be able for every woman to prevent that possibility, and also to change the attitudes in society and the attitudes that men hold of women, that we either like to be raped or that we're asking for it, and, you know, because of the way we dress, you know, we deserve it. These kinds of attitudes we're trying to get dismissed. A lot of people are very receptive to it, especially when you find out that, you know, 6-month-old babies up to 93-year-old women are getting raped. You know, and I don't think that, you know, a baby in a diaper is necessarily provocative and even knows what rape is, let alone how to ask for it. You know, and these things go on all the time. Over 50% of women who get raped are under the age of 16. One case I just wanted to briefly mention to tell you, like, how far spread it is just when I was in Philadelphia, the day before, a woman came in and she was 88 years old, and she was saving up her money, all the money that she ever had, which wasn't much, it was only, you know, a few hundred, that she'd been saving up for I don't know how long. She was putting away because she wanted to go to the Vatican. And she was a virgin, and she was raped, and her money was taken away from her. You know, this goes on, and still a lot of people believe that the only women that get raped are those that ask for it, and prostitutes, and, you know, women that are up to no good anyway. And we are really out to, you know, show that that's not true. And another myth that people hold is that rapists are sick. We don't believe this. We believe that that rapists are going for power, and especially when you're in a competitive society like ours, if you don't have control over, you know, family, a business, or something, people can go out and gain control over another person. A lot of rapists have testified to this, as well as in a mere study that was done in Philadelphia. He said that that was the primary motive of rape as well, from the reports that he got a hold of. One of the things that we're doing in terms of working with rapists, which sounds surprising, is there's a group called Prisoners Against Rape in Morton, Virginia, and they are men that are convicted rapists that have now seen their crime as being political, because they also know that while all men have the potential to rape, and there's a difference between that and the fact that all men do rape, but while all different types of men rape, and we know that dentists and doctors and lawyers and senators rape, as well as black men and sick men that foam at the mouth, which are the commonly held feelings that those are the only people that rape. Only the lower class non-white men are getting punished and put away for it, and therefore we don't support the penal system. And so they're talking about, Prisoners Against Rape is talking about a political analysis, you know, and what it is, and how to change attitudes of other young men, you know, to become responsible community organizers and be responsible to a constituency and, you know, not be succumbed to the things that people tell us that this is what we're supposed to do. You know, if competition is everything that we're supposed to strive for, we'll do it by any means necessary. So that's one of the projects that we've just taken on, is working with Prisoners Against Rape. And I think that although at first we're going to be hit with a lot of questions like, why are women who are against rape working with rapists? I think that, you know, in time people will understand and see that this is definitely exceptional, and I think it's really progressive. Another thing that we like to do is talking to high schools and junior high schools. We gave a seminar last year to all the health nurses in the school system of D.C., and it was very well received. And we're working on this, it's called the high school pamphlet now, and it's all the different things, all the procedures. What do you do if you've been raped? If you want to report it, what do you do? We found that a lot of women that have called us don't really know what to do. They don't know what to expect, let alone what to demand, because the best services that you can possibly get are not going to necessarily be offered to you, and you're going to have to know what's going to be best for you. And Darlene's going to go into the procedures of reporting a rape, which I think are really interesting, and they bring out a lot of the things that we're working on to change, and she'll bring in the suggestions. So the high school pamphlet, talking to high schools, doing self-defense demonstrations, we'd like to get self-defense incorporated into the physical education department as, you know, a part where all junior high and high school women would have to take it, just like you have to take basketball or volleyball and things like that. Why not train our bodies? Why not know, you know, what parts of our bodies we can use and what parts shouldn't we use and how to make, you know, certain moves natural reflexes and what natural reflexes aren't going to necessarily help us out if we're grabbed, those kinds of things. And we've gotten a lot of really good response with that. And also the high school and junior high school women love it as well. I mean, because they're just, you know, they're into it, they're alert, they're aware, and they're eager to learn. Another thing that we're going to be coming out with is called notes. Notes from the first year, supposedly, but now it's a year and a half. We have a problem in terms of funding. This is an anthology of all the articles and publications that we've put out so far, which is quite a bit because we do a bi-monthly newsletter as well as articles here and there and an annotated bibliography, all of the national contacts that we've had and resources, how to do things if you don't have enough people to set up a center, you know, how can you effectively gain power to make change for, you know, the condition of women who are in fear of getting raped. And as soon as we can get the money, we're going to have this published. That's another thing that we're trying to do, too, is fundraising. But as Carol Gidley pointed out, we're all working without pay, and we don't see that as anything heroic or anything to pat our shoulders on. As a matter of fact, we're pretty upset about it because we feel that our work is probably the most valid work that's going on. We have more successes than failures, and we have seen ourselves progressively move on, and we're sometimes surprised ourselves that we've been able to continue going without being totally burnt out. But yet the fact remains that we aren't getting paid, and, you know, bills aren't getting paid and things like that. So there's going to be a pitch about money later, of course. And as soon as we can get, you know, some type of funds to get some paid staff, then we can also pursue the bigger fundraisers too, because there are different things that are going on now with governmental agencies where there's money being offered and professionals are going and getting that money, whereas we should have just as much right to have a chance to get that money as well. We just don't even have the time. So other than, you know, the things that I've run down, that's pretty much what we do. Public speaking is one of our means of exposure, and using the media, we've gotten really good coverage and response from radio, television, and print. And we're really lucky about it because we take ourselves seriously and because we see what we're doing is being very serious. The media sees us that way as well. And the more respect that we command, the more respect we get. And I think that it's a good model structure for other women's groups and other groups that are organizing for change and for the women's movement in general. Thank you. Oh, and Charlene is going to speak next.
I'm not a person that gets angry very often. In fact, I sometimes have to intellectualize that I ought to be angry about something. But over the last few weeks, I've been extremely angry. I can't verify it with 100% surety because the log at our crisis center is an anonymous thing. We don't generally ask the name of victims who call us. But I'm about 99.9% sure that I spoke to the young woman who had been assaulted by the man out at Madeira School 2 years ago. She knew he was out of school. She was petrified. I mean, out of prison, I don't mean out of school. Whether or not the headmistress knew it, I think is her own secret. I don't tend to believe some of the things she said on the air about that. The woman who'd been attacked was also dealing with her own parents who didn't understand that 2 years after an attack, one could still be afraid. And she was afraid primarily because whether the fear is real or not real, there is a fear when you know the man who's assaulted you is back out in the street. It makes me very angry because when you're raped, you're told to hush it up. We don't want a dirty name around our school. It's cute, or it's you've invited it, or all the kinds of things that Karen mentioned. Unfortunately, it takes a murder for people to realize that rape is one step from murder very frequently. This also reflected back on another situation where in Southwest Washington, there were two rapes that involved weapons, which could have caused murder, where houses were broken into, and a few months later, after nothing happened after the rape, we saw the murder of Millicent Alouette, a very parallel situation. We've got to get people realizing that rape is not how it's defined legally in the books. Rape defined legally simply means vaginal intercourse against the will and by force of a woman. It doesn't even include the fact that you can be sodomized. And I think most of the women we've talked to dealing with the rape issue really don't care what part of their body is violated. The fact is, if you're sexually violated, it's against your will, it's rape. And so one of the things we're trying to do is change the definition. But I think even more important than just the legal definition is changing the attitudes. And as I say, very, very often, rape is one step from murder, and it's the fear of being killed, which is often the reason women submit. And there again, we run into a great deal of trouble between the word submit and consent. Very often, even police officers and lawyers will use the word submit, and the woman is defining submission as, defining consent as submission. And so she might use the word, yes, I consented, when in reality, what she's saying is, I submitted, and I probably submitted out of fear of some kind. Now, the threat of murder isn't always the coercive force that causes you to submit to a rapist. Another extreme in another area is economic coercion, and we do get testimony from women who lose jobs because they won't submit to sexual demands of bosses. And so that's just another kind of coercion that we also want included in the definition of rape legally. It doesn't have to be always physical mutilation that causes submission. Rape in itself is not necessarily something that involves a physical trauma. Many women who are mature have absolutely no signs whatsoever that there's been a rape. And so sometimes when you're examined by a medical officer, they think it's really cute and really funny because they don't see any in effects of violence physically. And so they'll make some offhand comment to a woman, how can you call this rape? I don't see any physical evidence. Well, again, rape to a victim is something that's real, not just a legal definition. And to her, she recognizes that rape is something that's in her head. It's something that's happened against her will, and it's a mind-blowing experience. It's not necessarily a physical experience. So we at the center have, as Karen mentioned, felt very strongly about supporting women who didn't report rape. But we've also felt there is validity as well in dealing with the institutions for the women who do report the rape. So I'll kind of run briefly through the institutions that are involved here, some of the things that have happened and some of the things we're working toward in terms of change. One of the things that happened before we got into the rape issue was the fact that we have an emergency number, 911. And I think if any of you have called that number, hopefully you have the same response that we find, that it's a fairly quick response. And this is certainly something that's appreciated by anybody who's in distress, is a quick response from the police department. However, sometimes that quick response is coupled by practically a community party of 6, 8, 10 officers coming at various times. There's often two persons in the patrol car, there are two local detectives, there's a couple sex squad officers, and sometimes there's a couple others thrown in. So one of the things we're trying to do is to bring that initial response from the police down to one person or at the most two, so that there's not a big crowd and not make such a big thing out of it. It is the responsibility of the patrol officer only to find out that a rape has occurred, in which case it's his responsibility to call the sex squad and to get a description of the assailant, because it is also part of their job to try to find him. It is not part of their job, we feel, and the sex squad is supporting us on this, to start asking details about the rape. A lot of the articles that are coming out about rape now talk about a lot of voyeuristic kinds of questions being asked by policemen. And oftentimes, these are the questions asked by the patrolman who is not trained, he's not professionalized or specialized. And oftentimes, again, they think this is really cute. And 9 times out of 10, they probably think the woman's lying and has fabricated this whole story anyway. And so we've just found it's better off for everybody if it's none of their business. If a woman says she's been sexually assaulted, they are then to call in the sex squad. Now, we're one step ahead of most parts of the country because we do have a specialized sex unit. And again, we don't like that word. I'd much rather have it called the Rape Investigation Unit, but at, right now it's still called the Sex Unit. They are specialized. Most cities do not even have a specialized, trained section of the police department to handle sexual offenses. So we have that one advantage. In terms of investigative techniques, I think the department here is quite progressive. The role that we've played with them is more in terms of sensitizing the people on there to realizing how some of their comments are interpreted by victims and to work on the sensitivity areas rather than too many of the procedural areas. If a woman reports it after the police come and the rape has been reported, she's taken to the hospital for a medical examination. If you don't ask to go somewhere else or nothing else is offered probably, you end up going to DC General, and about 75% of rape victims here do go to DC General, where there is no charge to the woman. However, if she doesn't want to wait at DC General, which had been a situation until recently, and she wanted to go to a private hospital, GW, Washington Hospital Center, or one of the others, she got to pay for being raped. She was sent the bill for the medical exam, which was for the state, because it's the state that prosecutes in a criminal action. And not only is she paying to be raped, she then finds out she's not even, you know, involved in the legal case, she's simply a witness to the event. So this gives you kind of a weird feeling when you find out you're just a witness for the state. So we're trying to work on finding a way that you don't have to pay to be a victim. And since we're working in the rape issue, of course, this has been our primary focus, but we're also advocating that no victim of a crime of violence should have to pay to be a victim. Crime is society's problem, and society should have ways of paying for this. The medical exam should be for two reasons. Sometimes it occurs that it's, in fact, only for one. She's a piece of evidence. So they examine you to see what kind of evidence they can collect from your body or from your clothing to use in the court case. The second half, which we feel is much more important, is that she's a human being with needs. She needs, sometimes they're medical, sometimes they're psychological, sometimes they're both. So we're putting a great deal of energy into working with the physicians that do the examinations, with the nurses in the emergency rooms, and all the personnel who are involved. I mentioned that we had a specialized sex squad. At this time, we do not have specialized units within the hospital to deal with rape victims. That we're again working with through the city council. We've got a medical roundtable now set up involving people from the various hospitals in Washington so that even if we don't limit the number of physicians and nurses, et cetera, who work with rape victims, at least we'll get some sensitivity training into the hospital procedure so that the fact that she's a human being with needs is number one priority. And getting the evidence for court is important and should be done better than it's done now. Sometimes it's very, very haphazard and we lose cases because of bad medical forensic evidence. So we're training the hospitals in both areas. The medical treatment involves prevention of pregnancy, over which I think probably a lot of you are aware there's a lot of controversy now about the safety or non-safety of sabestral, the morning after pill. Preventive medicine for VD, which is also controversial because you have to take a great huge quantity of penicillin, and sometimes it doesn't even prevent all the syphilis. So there is controversy over whether or not a woman should have preventive penicillin treatment or should wait 6 weeks to find out whether or not she got VD from the assault. Of course, if there is a pregnancy and it's not prevented, then there's the question of abortion or how to handle the pregnancy. These are some of the medical aspects that are involved here. The other one, of course, you mentioned is counseling. Right now, there's essentially no counseling provided for any woman who's a victim, other than she might happen to run into an individual who's kind of nice, but it's not part of the system. And going clear back to my original definition of rape, it's something that's against your mind, and it's a very traumatic experience at the time. And so the emotional support and counseling is one of the prime motivations for the Rape Crisis Center forming, that we recognize the victims were not getting support and were not getting counseling. The kind of support that we give women who call the center is a little different than the kind that's being developed by, say, psychiatric nurses or other hospital staff who work in the hospitals. One of the differences is that we must rely on women calling us, and so they tend to approach us with very factual questions, and we sometimes can lead into supportive rap, because they often want to know if the feelings that they have are normal or not. They don't know whether their feelings of being dirty are normal or not. They don't know whether their feelings of wanting to move are normal or not. They don't know why they want to take 10 showers a day. They don't know why they can't relate to their husband on a sexual level again. They don't know why they're not functioning in their job. I mean, the rape intensifies so many different areas of one's life. And in counseling, both through the center on that kind of level and as we find and get documentation of counseling within the hospital setting, we find that oftentimes the rape is not at all what's the primary concern of the victim. It simply brings forward kind of other things that were already there in her life. Through my work with the Prince George's County Task Force, we have been able to get a psychiatric nurse at PG General Hospital to see each victim as she comes into the emergency ward. And it's very interesting that this has just been going for 2 or 3 months, but of the women that she was unable to meet in the emergency room and could only contact via letter or telephone, the number of women keeping their appointments has been extremely low. But of the women she was able to meet in the emergency room, chat with them for a few minutes, develop a certain amount of trust between them, her follow-up for the appointments has been almost 100%. And we have examples of the non-hysterical woman, the woman who seems very calm in the emergency room. And in one case, they called her and said, "Nancy, we've got a woman, but she looks like she's just fine. I don't know if you even want to come down." Well, she did. And she met the woman. And of all the victims she's seen, this is the woman who absolutely came out with the most bottled up problem of any of them. So there's a very definite myth that rape victims are hysterical and I don't know what. Rape also often doesn't even show its impact for a number of hours or days. Often the impact is very, very much delayed. So we're developing different ways of supporting women in counseling. And we've gotten away from using the word counseling because sometimes that implies a helping relationship. And we like the word support so that the women we deal with are kind of more on an equal basis. That some of us have gone through the experience, some of us haven't, but there's kind of an empathetic relationship rather than feeling that the counselor has any kind of answers for you. So we like the word support in that area. In the legal area, a lot of times the rape occurs and the trial doesn't come up for a whole year. So you've just about gotten it out of your life and whatever, and then the trial comes. And Karen again has intimated at how often the woman is considered guilty. She's considered the one who provoked it, brought it on herself. If there's something she should have done or shouldn't have done or whatever. And the law, the way it stands now, has corroboration requirements, and corroborate means to have testimony beyond the word of the victim. And rape is the only crime for which this is true. If you are robbed, you can testify, the defense attorney will cross-examine you, and the jury can make a decision. But this is not true with rape. You have to have medical evidence, you have to have proof that there was force, you have to have, so again, like verbal coercion would be very hard to prove under that situation. A weapon used to get you to submit, which is not found, would mean it would be very hard to prove that this was done by force and against your will. How does anybody analyze anybody's mind about the issue of consent so that there's no techniques for really analyzing a woman's mind at the time of the occurrence? If a woman comes into a court a year after it's happened and she's pretty much together physically and maybe even capable of talking about it under controlled emotions, they don't see what the big deal is. She's functioning now, I don't see what the big problem is, and we don't want to put away a man for a great number of years against a woman who's functioning, all right, or seems to be functioning. So there's, again, a lot of attitudes that have been built into the law. And I think if you'll think about the institutions we've been talking about, the hospitals, the police, the law, you might notice that these are pretty much male-dominated institutions, and what are we dealing with? We're dealing with a population that's primarily women. And in the law, we're dealing with women as victims simply because the lawyers decided that rape was going to be vaginal penetration. So there's no legal way that a man can be raped. He can be forcibly sodomized. But it's both legally is not, it doesn't happen as often, and just in practice, even if we get the sex out of the victim in terms of the rape laws, we still are going to deal with a society where women are primarily the victims. One of the things that happens in the courtroom also happens in general society. We find a lot of times the lawyers don't like women on the juries. And this seems kind of strange because you would think women would have some understanding of the plight of a victim. But the contrary seems to be true. They're the ones that often come up with these statements, I would have, I wouldn't have, and every kind of excuse that keeps them in a category separate from the rape victim. The same things happen with your friends, with your family. Why were you here? Why were you there? Why didn't you? Why? I think what this is simply a psychological protection for our own egos to say, victims are they and we are we, and they're two different groups. And I think one of the things we as women have to begin thinking about and admitting to ourselves, not even admitting, just recognizing, that we are all potential victims. And that the facts of rape are that women often are victimized not because of things they have done intentionally, but just because they're women or just because they happen to be at a certain place at a certain time, or someone's been watching you and has decided to attack you. Rape is a planned event. It's not a spontaneous, passionate kind of thing. It is planned. So we have to recognize that victims aren't asking to be raped, and we have to recognize that we are potential victims, and therefore quit separating ourselves by the we and the they, that we're all in it together, and have women's attitudes toward other women that are more realistic. Men do the same kind of thing by denying in themselves any potential for acting out this kind of violence. So we have to deal with violence on an individual level, we have to deal with violence on a cultural level, which in our society is predominantly expressed by men in physical terms, therefore the problem of rape being primarily a male problem. We have to get away from all these protectiveness of ourselves. On the other hand, the law is saying that there are things that you can do to protect yourself, and we hear a lot of anti-crime kinds of tactics like, you know, shut your window and watch where you're going, and Sue will go into some practical things for women to think about. But the other day I was reading a letter to the editor saying that the woman works till 12 or 1 o'clock at night. Every single night she has to decide which is better for her, to risk a $15 or $5 parking ticket because she parks within 40 feet of the corner or a fire hydrant, or the risk of being out on the street. And yet if she were to be raped because she's out on the streets, she would probably be accused if it was her fault because she was out on the streets and not protecting herself. So we've got to think about legal questions that go just beyond changing the law for conviction rates in the rape issue. Another area for prevention and legally would be the responsibility of management for the apartment buildings that a lot of us live in. They're the ones that don't provide the proper locks. They're the ones that often don't have adequate screens and facilities on windows. And tenants aren't strong enough at this point to really demand some of these things, but I think we have to look at the responsibility of management and people who do rent for some of the problems that involve break-ins. I have heard, I haven't verified this, that in New York they've now passed a law where if the landlord isn't able to eliminate break-ins, and this wouldn't necessarily be rape, but any kind of break-in into the apartment building, they cannot say no dogs allowed, so that at least tenants have the option of having a dog as one protective tool. I think just to summarize some of the things we're talking about here, we're talking about specializing the people who deal with rape in the institutions. We're talking about normalizing the laws to bring the rape laws in line with other laws. And we're talking about professionalizing the people within the professions. We have certainly advocated that more women get into the police department, get into dealing with rape victims in the hospital and as lawyers. We feel that it is possible to professionalize men, and there are some men who are good with women, but we feel that a feminist woman is just that much better to deal with women as victims. So we've been advocating change. The DC City Council hearings are bringing about some changes. We've seen some changes in PG County. Montgomery County is now having a task force on rape. The rape task force, a big one up in New York City now. And I think we're really on the way to beginning to change some of the structure. But just one other thing, again, we don't want any of these legal and institutional changes to eradicate our concern with the women who don't report it. And we've got to find ways that these women are just as much supported as those who do report it.
The most difficult thing I ever had to deal with when I started taking self-defense was my own mental outlook. And as I've been working with a lot of other women in this particular field, I've noticed that it's a common problem. We are taught as children to be weak, that we are weak, to be passive. We never want to hurt anyone, which is an excellent quality under normal circumstances, but in an attack situation, one of the ways that you can deal with a lot of things and get out of a lot of situations is to be able to respond aggressively, be able to assert yourself, perhaps, you know, cause your attacker enough harm so that you can get out of the situation. Now, in schools and all their lives, men are taught to be strong. They're taught to be aggressive. They're taught that physical strength is an attribute. I know that one of the scariest and yet saddest things I've seen on TV is an advertisement for a local karate studio where this whole gymnasium full of little boys are being taught karate and self-defense, which is excellent. They should be taught how to defend themselves, but there wasn't one little girl in there. And here they are starting young, getting this type of mindset. Women don't have a chance. So when you get to be about, 20 to 30 and you start thinking in these terms, it's really difficult to, think about hitting somebody, to use your body in a strong way against someone else. Just the whole mental outlook can help you on the street. If you are confident about the way that you can operate, like if someone does attack you, if you're confident that you could respond aggressively, you're more likely to be walking tall, being aware of what's going on around you. There's a possibility you're less likely to be victimized if you're sort of, shuffling down the street and looking down and not looking where you're going. Chances are that you could be marked as a victim, as someone who would be easy to rape, easy to attack, easy to have their purse stolen. If you walk down the street, very aware of what's going on around you, looking back if you suspect someone's back there, speeding up your steps, looking people in the eyes, being aware of like groups of men on the street you'd want to avoid, being aware in your own home of things you could be using as weapons, of how you could receive help in an emergency situation. All these things, rather than making you suffer from paranoia, give you a confidence which is helpful and a psychological advantage in any type of attack situation. In stressing rape prevention, the Rape Crisis Center has compiled a list of practical tactics similar to a few of the things that I just mentioned that will be available as you leave. So I'd like everyone to pick up on those. Now, self-defense is basically study of using the strong points of your body against the weak points of an attacker. Now, what you can turn into a strong point in your own self is your own mental outlook, the knowledge that you are not defenseless, that with a few skills you can fight back in a lot of situations. And this also has to do with the confidence and the awareness which will help you in any number of situations. Using your eyes in an attack situation, if you can stare at your attacker rather than looking down, if you can pull that together, there's a lot of fear involved, and some women, just aren't always able to do that. But if you can look him straight in the eyes, this will have an intimidating effect, like you're not going to stand for whatever it is that he's planning on doing to you. At the same time, if you're looking at him, unless he's a trained fighter, he's going to be looking toward the part of you that he's going for next. And so you'll be able to telegraph his move and respond against it. Also, if you can stare at your attacker, you can use all your peripheral vision to be watching for a place to run. In self-defense, we teach women
to be able to strike, to be able to get away as quickly as possible, to run, not to sit around and pummel an attacker until he's bloody and take a lot of training to do that. Now, the voice is another really strong point. There's a man in California who teaches women self-defense by the name of Gerald Osteen, and he's done a rather, I guess it's an informal study, of women who have gotten out of attack situations, and 60% of the women he talked to did it by noise methods alone, either by using whistles, which until recently was a really good alarm-type device. There are other alarm devices available. Or by talking their attackers out of it. We've talked to a lot of women who've been able to psych out what their attacker wants to hear and talk them out of situations. And then just absolute screaming and yelling. I'd like to mention a word about psychological advantage of yelling as opposed to screaming. If you're in an attack situation and you shriek shrilly and sound fearful, this will reinforce your own fears. It'll make him think that you are afraid and you'd be an easier victim. If you can train yourself to respond with a yelp, that karate ki is excellent. What it is a sharp exhalation of breath from your diaphragm. So rather than sounding sort of, you know, ah, you can train yourself to respond with a hoo, which is also intimidating. Besides being intimidating, that particular yell makes any blow that you give more powerful, the tension, and also makes you less likely to get hurt if there's a blow coming at you. Okay, there are strong and weak points of the human body, which if you can know them, if you can remember them in a situation, they'll help you out a whole lot. Like striking, beating at an attacker's chest like this, you know, won't do that much good because his chest is, you know, fairly together. You have to know where to hit and what to use. I'm going to point out the weak points of my attacker here with my strong points. First of all, the temples are a really weak point. You can use, you know, make your fists real tight, really tense. Whenever you use your hands doing anything, make them very tense and very tight. Okay, if you're grabbed with your arms like this and your arms are free, you can use your fist against the temple as hard as you can. You just come around as hard as you can. Chances are you're going to stun him enough that you'll be able to get away. Yelling, whenever you try any of these things, yelling is also good. The type of hoo from the diaphragm, really excellent. The ears, the same thing. If your arms are free, you can slightly cup your hands. It takes very little strength. You can try it, you know, on your own ears. With very little strength coming down, you create a vacuum. You can break an eardrum. Give you enough time to get away. Now, the eyes are an excellent weak point. First of all, let me say, if someone's choking you like this, they mean business, and you have three seconds to respond. So the eyes are one of the most effective places. Tensing your thumb, using your finger scraping, can even bend over your wrist, tense it up, and right in the eyeball. You feel that fits right in an eyeball socket. You'll see red for a while, long enough for you to be able to run. The nose is a weak point. You can come down on it. Well, height might make a difference, too. Just the punching it. You can tense your hand like this, tense, and use the heel of the palm and come up underneath here. This particular strike is effective also under the jaw. Okay, the mouth region is sensitive, and, you know, just a regular punch to that area will bring fairly good results. The neck is a weak point, all sides of it. The back, and the side. Use the side. You can use the sides of your hand in the old karate chop. What this is just extending your fingers, tensing the whole business, and aiming with this. You get a little circular motion into it. Really strong. Okay. Once again, if you're being choked from the front, you've got 3 seconds. So, as he's acting against your trachea, it's a good thing to respond in kind, because it's fairly effective. If you can tense your fingers over really tight and go for his, you can feel just how much pressure you need to start cutting off your air, and you want to double that. Okay, and just, you know, put your whole body into it and go, right like that. He's trying to kill you. It's a good chance you could break his windpipe that way. He means business. You have to respond in like. Okay, the solar plexus is a weak point. The solar plexus is right below the sternum. You can feel it. There's a whole group of nerve endings. When someone gets the wind knocked out of them, it's because their solar plexus, they've been hit there. Okay, if you're...